Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
The weather is brisk. Practices are underway. Scrimmages are going on. It is fall ball time in college lacrosse. We have a special Inside Lacrosse Podcast fall ball edition, week one of the fall. I'm Matt Kinnear here with Terry Foy and Kevin Brown, and we're going to talk about the scrimmages in week one and some of the places we've been in fall ball 2022. Guys, how you feeling?
I feel great. I hope that Kevin's allergies are not going to act up during this podcast. Otherwise, we're going to get some new sound effects for the library.
The only thing I'm allergic to is not having lacrosse around. Fire it up, baby.
So there's the corniest intro we've done in a podcast so far, but it's all good. I love it. I love the energy. I love the fall too. I've said this many times. I think I've said this every year if you've been listening to the similar podcast, that fall is my favorite time of year to be in the lacrosse industry. The weather is not freezing or boiling. You get awesome access to the players and to the coaches and to all the action. And, you know, we get to see kind of behind the curtain a little bit and kind of a peek into practice and the formative parts of these lacrosse teams that we're going to be following all next year. So, guys, we're going to start with you two because you've been to, you know, arguably the two biggest scrimmages of that we're going to see in the fall. With Terry, you were at the Bob Kemp Lacrosse Classic of Harvard and North Carolina. And Kevin, the packed house in Springfield Township up in Pennsylvania, watching the defending national champions Maryland play against Cornell, a rematch of that national championship game, an awesome crowd and an awesome experience. So lots of stuff to digest from this. Terry, we're going to start with you with a little bit of analysis, but I want to kind of pose this question to both of you guys. You know, what is a fall ball scrimmage and what do you look for in these? Terry, you've got, you know, 10 years experience, 12 years experience doing this. So I'll start with you. You know, what are the things that you're looking for while you're watching these teams play?
Well, generally, any game, regardless whether it's in the spring, summer, or fall, when you're in our role, it's so much easier to and so much more productive, or the quality is going to be so much better if you can go into a game with expectations that you can either confirm or contrast against. And, you know, the timing was fortunate in the sense that I did my top 20 last week, or the week prior to these scrimmages. And so as a result, I already had formed, like, you know, pretty firm expectations for each of these teams heading into the scrimmage. But then with respect to what's unique in the fall, you have to remember that there's this weird dance between caring about winning and not caring about winning. These guys are competitive. These women are competitive. They always want to win, but they also see the bigger picture and understand that, you know, if that guy is carrying a lagging injury, or if, you know, that sophomore really needs more development time than the senior does, they're going to make choices in the interest of the bigger picture. So understanding the acute motivations of the coaching staff is really important relative to coming away with confirmed or contrasted expectations. So as it relates particularly to Carolina and then this Carolina-Harvard scrimmage, like, Tar Heels were playing without as many as six starters and probably like 11 contributors. So what does that mean in terms of how it informs what I think they could be or should be? Well, it means that I've got a pretty clear picture of what I saw, but I have to be mindful of what I didn't see. And I think you wrap all that into this notion of, we don't know how much to value the fall relative to essentially the guesswork that we do on an annual basis. When you take away the graduating seniors, you add the freshmen and the transfers, and you just guess on what you think it's going to look like with the returners. There's a ton of value in actually seeing what it looks like, but there's also some threat of overreacting, so you got to avoid that too.
Yeah, Terry, I the last year, I remember I saw Princeton, and they played in a series of scrimmages with Towson and Lehigh, and I was like, oh my God, these guys are amazing. You know, this Princeton team is going to be fantastic. I also saw Harvard, and they played in a series of scrimmages, you know, involved with High Point, Hobart, and Hopkins. And, you know, I had a similar vibe, maybe not quite as strong as Princeton.
And that played out because Harvard was not quite as good as Princeton. I mean, they were on one very important day, but they weren't necessarily on the season in total.
So I did maybe undervalue those performances a little bit. So there is a little bit, like you said, it's a dance where, like, you have to trust your gut if you see a team that just looks like they have it. But you have to have enough information to know, all right, these guys are missing. You know, it looks like they're working on something, maybe not trying to be the best versions of themselves, but being the most productive versions of themselves for the end goal that they see in the spring. So there is a little bit of a dance of guesswork. And sometimes, you know, I've seen the flip side where there's been teams in fall ball that, you know, look like they're just going to crush everybody. And then you get to the spring and they're just not what you expected. Kevin, you saw a rematch of the national championship game. So obviously the expectations of what to get out of this one, you know, are elevated, so to speak. You know, these are two teams that are the most newsworthy and noteworthy in the country. You know, what were you looking to get out of these scrimmages when you went up there to Springfield?
Yeah, no, it's to Terry's point. You're looking at a lot of the new personnel for these teams. Cornell had a number of starters out themselves with Gavin Adler, one of the best defensemen in all Division One. He starting goalie Chase Erland, starting attackman Michael Long, and Aiden Blake was pretty injured last year, so they were all banged up in fall ball and didn't risk any further aggravation. So the biggest injury news obviously came from Maryland sideline with Eric Maliver. Feel bad for him, man. He really did the number on his right leg there, both the torn ACL and MCL and broken tibia. So he'll be out for the spring season, and he's getting surgery in a couple weeks to remedy that. And he looked upbeat, so he's looking positive and ready to attack it. But yeah, you're looking. What I'm most excited, because I like to see the depth on these teams too. You know, like second half comes around, you see some fans filing out, getting ready for the Eagles game up there in Springfield. I'm fired up to see the third line midfield. You know, it's pretty exciting for me, but. No, the new personnel for Maryland, it's obviously the headline is offensively they lose their top five scorers. So seeing how the new look offense looks against you know, national championship finalist is pretty exciting. You know, some areas of concern not being as historic or efficient as last year, but you look on the other end of the field and the end result is around 13-5. So it's like you're holding a pretty good, talented team on the other end that low. The headline is, as you both got guys have written in the fall here, that it might be a shift from a historically great offense to a defensive laden team.
You know, one of the unique things about both of the scrimmages you guys went to, and it's something we've seen in the past, particularly Maryland, the jersey numbers changed. You know, John Tillman has done this in the past with a number of scrimmages, switching up the pennies, you know, maybe not allowing people to get as much of a scout on them and as much of a feel for the personnel. It's something we dealt with in stories last year and prior years. And, you know, we find our ways and we're familiar enough with the personnel that, you know, they can change the jerseys, but we still know who they are. Terry, there was a similar thing with North Carolina where they had different jersey numbers. What do you guys think of that in fall ball?
I mean, I just think it's the victims, so to speak, are the people who you shouldn't want to victimize and you don't benefit from victimizing. So I was asking the Harvard staff about Carolina personnel after the game and they didn't know who they were. And it wasn't because they switched their numbers. It was because they don't actually play Carolina in a game that matters. So they don't have to know who the personnel is. But any coach who is playing Carolina, in a game that matters, is going to know who Dewey Egan is, even though he is wearing a different jersey number. So the effect is lost. Whereas the, you know, neutral fans who are just big lacrosse consumers, right? They go to the game wanting to know, you know, how's Dom Petromala look? And they don't know that he's in street clothes on the sidelines because there's a number 77 on the field and it's not Dom Petromala. So to me, it is another reflection of the fact that there aren't enough choices made to serve the fan. There are too many choices made in order to find a 1% competitive edge in a game where the margins are very rarely that narrow, especially when you prolong it over time, right? Like, the value of not being able to scout this game, presuming that you were able to get your hands on the field, on the tape, when you don't play for 75 days or 100 days, whatever it is, you know, it's moderately different than if you do it at the end of January and you play on February 7th. But even then, when we dealt with this, you know, Maryland played scrimmage BU on, you know, the end of January, and then they played High Point like a week or two later. When High Point got their hands on that film, they knew who every Maryland player was, regardless of what jersey number he was wearing. Meanwhile, we're the ones that misidentify Jack Brennan as Dawson Wynn.
Yeah, Coach Jovanovski is quaking in his boots, getting ready for John Tillman's team this weekend for the Fall Classic, not knowing who's who on the film. But no, I think they slipped a little bit this year. Usually,
well,
they...
keep in mind the two of Maryland's assistant coaches play for the U.S. national team, if memory serves. So I'm pretty confident that they're going to be able to figure out who's who.
Well, not to mention the fact that they did slip a little bit this year, that they wore their game shorts so everyone could see. Not everyone. I had to stalk out the handshake line post game, and I was like squinting at everyone, make sure I got the numbers right. But yeah, you know.
Well, the other thing, too, is that when you talk to the coaches and they talk about the actual player's performance, doesn't it completely nullify the spirit of the idea? Like, lie to me and tell me that the third long stick midi is the one who scored 6 goals, because that's whose number the best attackman was wearing. You know what I mean? Like, at least, like, take the ruse all the way to its natural conclusion.
Yeah, wouldn't it be silly if they're just, like, completely, like, they do a complete interview within their head, they have, well, this guy, this number, this guy's wearing this number, and just completely play mind games for, you know, the whole 5 months leading up to the season.
Well, so you do it's that like on Sunday, and then I go visit your practice on Tuesday, and they wear their proper numbers, and you just tell me exactly everything about the personnel that I want to know. I mean, it's like the dichotomy is so stark and so silly.
Yeah, it's silly, and you know, I could be even more pointed and say that, like, it's just dumb. Like, it's just dumb. I appreciate the fact that, you know, these programs and these coaches take it that seriously. You know, that lacrosse has evolved to a point where the game and the stakes are so high that you are looking for every single competitive edge. But I think the spirit...
Well, let me push back on that. Sorry, I will let you finish your point. But my argument is that when spring football games are televised, the players wear the right numbers, right? Like, my argument is that it hasn't evolved far enough where there is enough respect for the spectator in the department that coaches aren't allowed to do things that would give them the best competitive advantage.
Right. I'm not saying it's a valid way to get a competitive edge. I'm just saying that's what they think in their mind, is I need to get every competitive edge possible, and this is the way that they think they can do it. But, you know, fall ball, like, you know, I wrote a story about the Bob Kemp Lacrosse Classic a few weeks ago, and, you know, the whole point of it was it's a gathering for the community in D.C. lacrosse. Obviously, they're raising money, and it's for all the, you know, the Georgetown Prep, the Gonzaga, all those alums from all those places, and, you know, the parents to hang out with not only just players, you know, their kids, but the kids on the other team who, you know, are graduates of their high school. It's a lacrosse community thing, and, you know, it's not serving that community by switching up the numbers. So, whatever. We've already talked too much about it. We've worked around it, so it's not a big deal to us, but it's just one of those things where, you know,
it's one of those classic, like, journalist yells at clouds, yells at, like, the airport missing the travel flight kind of thing.
Yeah, like, you know, it's but I did have people, like, you know, I have had people say, like, well, who was playing this, or, you know, fans and people who are not in media or whatever, confused and frustrated with it as well. So it's not just an us problem. In fact, it's not an us problem at all, because we figure out our way around it. But getting into the nitty-gritty of it, Kevin, you talked about this offense, and, you know, there are so many for Maryland, and there are so many different. It was a historically great offense last year, and uniquely unselfish in the way that it was historically great last year. That's going to be tough to replicate, and you throw the Malivar injury on top of that. What stood out to you about this offensive group, and should Terrapin fans be worried about that end of the field?
What stood out is the fact that they're still, like, just as unselfish. Like, so they graduate Wisnowskis, Khan, DeMayo, Donville, and Maliver's injured, right? So that's the top five. Kyle Long's the sixth leading scorer, and he's the spark plug. He had two more points his junior season than his senior season last year. And while that doesn't seem like a lot, but from the eye test, it seemed like he deferred a lot during their title run. So he was very content to let Wisnowskis or anyone else kind of get the money shot, right? But it's like, you lose that much talent, you gotta be a little more selfish. And maybe I'm wrong that he doesn't have to take the impetus and kind of invert a bunch and get all these assists, but he's so unselfish that he's just gonna move it. Whatever the correct read is, he's almost guaranteed to beat whoever he's guarding. That's how quick he is. But the other contributors we've seen before.
Well, hold on. Before we move off of Kyle Long, if you're talking about him inverting a ton, why don't they just consider doing what they've done with Connor Kelly or Mike Shannonchuk and actually have him play attack?
Great question. And that leads me to Owen Murphy. That's how good he looked beyond the net. The amount of shiftiness that I saw from him on Sunday was, I mean, all last season, it was pretty much just he would find the open spot in the offense and settled sets and just let it rip sidearm or on the fast break. He was an absolute menace. So to see him change direction, roll dodge three times and blow past people and skip it over the top of the defense over to Danny Maltz for a nice quick release bounce shot, it's like that's a welcome sign for Jake Bernhardt's offense. It's there's still going to be a lot of contributors that are returning with Maltz, Murphy, Jack Corris is still there. I don't think he got a lot of time or if he played, I didn't see him much. Jack Brennan was out there. He looks even bigger. And he's a guy that I want to see step up a little more and get more dodging opportunities. But yeah, this offense is going to stay unselfish. And I think that's the biggest takeaway. It's not like they're going to change the style of play just because they graduated everyone.
Yeah. And like, you know, you mentioned Maltz there and like, you know, look at Maltz's role and how much, you know, last year he basically became and, you know, took in, I don't want to say a lesser role, but a different role, moving just to the man up, you know, because
you can say it was a lesser role. Starting attack to man up specialist is,
well, it's maybe a lesser role in terms of minutes, but it's the best role in the sport.
Big time.
In terms of wear and tear in your body and versus the glory you can get from it.
Well, but, it's literally in Kevin's Twitter bio is that he is a wannabe extra man specialist.
I'm so jealous. Him and Lewis Dubik in recent years have captured my heart.
But I mean, that just goes to show like how many guys are like how great this offense was last year and how many guys that they still have who can take on an expanded role and be one of the best units in the country. Just, I mean, you know, it's kind of like we say we're going to talk about Team USA here, you know, Team USA A versus Team USA B, like either one of the teams could win. Maryland is a college program that is, you know, I won't quite say it's the same, but you know, Maryland's second team could put up a pretty good fight against Maryland's first team. So, Kevin, with that in mind, with
that's why they praise the scout team so much.
Yeah, exactly.
They want to knock them down and make them complacent so that they don't come out with their hair on fire and steal their jobs.
Honestly, it's a double-edged sword, right?
How's that?
With making the backups a little too, they're like feeling themselves a little bit, and then they come out and practice and start getting the starting minutes. No, but that doesn't usually happen.
Yeah. So then, what do you want to see from Maryland versus Team USA this weekend? What's that next? I don't say next step, but you know, what's more that you want to learn about them?
Yeah, just a little more fluidity to the offense, right? You're coming out from a alumni game is the one game experience they have in the fall, so it's to be expected that they're going to be a little rusty, a little not moving super coherently with their offensive movement and stuff. But I would like to see just a little more consistency with that and the off-ball movement, and see how their defense does. Obviously, Brett Maycard drew the CJ Kirst assignment, and he did pretty well for majority of it. CJ got his with a couple goals, but the Ajax and Zapatella was one of the revelations of 2022 season, and he looks primed to be a number 1B cover defenseman, and looks like Colin Burris is at least the third guy for now. He got those minutes against Cornell, and their rope unit was pretty spectacular after losing Jake Higgins, Roman Pugliese, and Alex Smith, plus Bubba Fairman, who converted last season. So it's seeing them reload in that area against a really athletic Team USA midfield will be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I'm you know, this defense, like you kind of said earlier, you know, was a historically great offense last year, and this defense looks like it's, you know, if historically great is maybe too strong, at least a very special defensive group. I'm curious to see them against the best attackmen and best midfielders in the world against Team USA and kind of see how they hold their own against that group. Terry, with everything Kevin has just said and with the news of the Maliver injury, you had Maryland number one in your way ahead top 20 rankings. Does this change your mind at all?
No. I mean, and it's not to undersell the contribution that Eric Maliver was poised to make this season. But I start from the standpoint of they basically have 8 goals per game to give back. And if they're going, and it's not to say that like you can win the national championship by winning games by an average of 1 goal per game. That's not realistic. But so, all right, say they,
which for our listeners is the margin of victory they won.
The average margin of victory in their 18-0 season. Yes, they won by like 8 2/3 a goal per game or something crazy like that. And it was, you know, the largest margin since 1990. And for an undefeated team. So, but you know, they can still probably be nearly undefeated or win the national championship by winning by an average of 5 goals per game. So if you can give up 3.5 to 4 goals per game and still achieve your goals, that is an incredible cushion. And one of the considerations is that they might allow fewer goals. Now, Kevin, and this is one of the things that he said that gives me more consolation or you know, eases my mind. The defensive unit that you would be concerned about is the short stick D midfield unit, because there's very little experience returning. So the fact that, did you say you thought that they played well and you were impressed by the group that got ran out?
Yeah, they were great. They're great. Jordy Holmes was the guy that caught my eye. He was wearing number 26. I think he's like 34 or something on the actual roster. I have never seen him play, and he was all over the place, right? He was on the wings of faceoffs. I think second possession Cornell had. I forget who the midfielder was, but he straight up. What's your term for ragdoll or something?
Yes, that is ragdolls. Yep, the Bo Peterson.
He put him on his butt and stripped him while he was on the ground. So that was fun to watch. He was really good. Coach Tillman also shouted out Alex Wicks and what's our Bowden transfer,
O'Donnell Mullane.
Yes, he also got good minutes. Long stick midfielder.
What about Donovan Lacey, the Sacred Heart transfer? Was he in the mix?
Yeah, Tillman gave him a shout out as well. He played. I think it was him and Dulane that were on the kind of second D mid unit. But Jack McDonald was really good at LSM too.
Yeah, Bob, he's an attackman at Bowden and kind of led their great run last year. So, you know, not unique in that a guy kind of moving to a new squad and taking that short stick D mini role and kind of that's the way he sees his impact on the field. But good for him, you know, contributing there. Terry, you were going to say something?
Well, I think at the offensive end of the field, one of the things that's so interesting is that, you know, Maryland's offense last year was potentially historically great. You know, I want to get a few years removed in order to kind of come to that conclusion. But the, you know, most substantial aspect of it was that they didn't have a traditional quarterback, right? Relative to certainly the Jared Bernhardt years, but even relative to pretty much any other team in college across. You know, when you look at the distribution of their production and you look at the way in which they functionally unfolded, right, in terms of where players were on the field and who were the primary initiators and everything that goes along with that, you know, they were so different that I do think that with Molliver leading the way, you would have expected them to revert a little bit more to what they looked like with Bernhardt leading the show. And it's not to say that Eric Molliver and Jared Bernhardt are super similar players, but it is to say that they fill roles similarly. So now, absent him, I wonder if maybe there's a little bit more motivation to try to emulate what they did last year. And it's certainly not to say that it's going to be as successful without, you know, a 6'5 lefty bomber who probably should have been, because I believe he wasn't the rookie of the year in the PLL. But, you know, doesn't mean that there aren't principles within the offense that are going to allow it to be successful with the personnel that gets run out this year, be it, you know, Jack Brennan or Kyle Long or, you know, Owen Murphy.
Kevin, Cornell, you mentioned they were missing a lot of guys. You highlighted Kirst, you know, which I think is the obvious, you know, person to look to, particularly after, you know, the summer and what he did last spring. And then you also highlighted the midfield. But, you know, overall, minus these pieces that we know are good, and, you know, Adler is probably the biggest name there. Do you see from Cornell what we saw last spring?
Not yet. They got a ways to go, and Coach Connor Busick said as much post-game. It's good film to watch and some kinks to work out, but it's... Yeah, it's the first fall ball scrimmage. You can't expect them to be the finished form that they were in the title run we saw in the postseason. But they got a lot of the compete level, that's for sure. It's Angelo Petrakis was, he is battling for every faceoff. The middle field battles were really fun to watch. The defense was swarming. Wyatt Nunst, I think, had a few highlight reel saves, and they were like Hugh Kelleher is just I would like to see him take the game by its neck a little more. You know, he's such a downhill dodger that he can just put his shoulder into anyone and then get a slide real easy. Billy Coyle, he was thrown in an attack for Michael Long. Didn't do much. He is better at getting short sticks and then inverting that way, right? So it's seeing them at full strength will definitely be a different story. But I like the compete level for sure. It's a lot of these guys are some of the unknowns too. Like they graduate John Piatelli. His brother steps up with a nice goal on the right wing, just catch and shoot action, and then just looking at some of the other personnel is gonna be interesting. I wish we got to see them more in this fall ball, because I wish I focused a little more on their personnel to come away from Sunday.
They're a team that, you know, and it's weird because I think in the spring it maybe just took us all six games to really like feel for who they are, and then they had some injuries that they dealt with, and you know, next thing you know, they're in the national championship game, and that compete level, like you said, has been the recurring theme throughout all of it with that team and that program, you know, historically as well. Terry, you went down to the D.C. area for the Bob Kemp Lacrosse Classic, Harvard versus North Carolina. And I want to start with North Carolina because we had a conversation and you alluded to this in your top 20 rankings that North Carolina might be the most interesting team in college lacrosse this year. Why is that, and what did you see?
Because so much of who they were last year evolved around Chris Gray, and that which didn't evolved around Chris Gray, Nicky Solomon, and Jacob Kelly. So when you look at their production, when you look at how their midfield has emerged or didn't emerge over the course of the season and how reliant they were on those three guys who are now gone, there's a huge open question in terms of what they're going to look like. And the second element of it that makes it interesting is that you can have a reasonable expectation that they're going to rely on guys who weren't even on the team last year, be them freshmen or transfers. The change to the, I believe it's the Keenan Flagler Business School admission policies has been dramatic in terms of the, you know, ability for someone like Logan McGovern from Bryant or Harry Welford from Bucknell, I believe JT Rozelle from Marist is the third grad transfer to come in and, you know, not have to either get a certification or pursue something other than business, because it used to be that, you know, the most of the candidates, like 95% of applicants to Carolina's business school required 5 years of professional experience before being eligible to really be considered and admitted. That policy has changed since COVID, and it is shaping up to be a really valuable asset for Joe Bresci's program. But then in addition to that, there's, you know, attackmen in Don Petromala and James Matten who were shaping up to be contributors early as well. Now, I mentioned earlier that the story of the scrimmage was the guys who did not participate in many respects. So among the attackmen, it was Petromala and Matten, and then Sean Goldsmith, the grad transfer from Mercer. Matten was kind of playing both attack and midfield in practice before getting injured. I believe he broke his collarbone. And then in addition to that, sophomores Johnny Schwartz and Antonio DeMarco were running with Matten on the first midfield. So, you know, it's unclear whether or not both Goldsmith and Petromala were starters. But if they were, then presumably five of the six starters on offense were missing. So as a result, Dewey Egan, Lance Tillman, and Logan McGovern were the starting attack, and then the first midfield was Welford, and then Quentin O'Connell and Griffin Gallagher, a transfer from Gettysburg. So essentially the second midfield became the first midfield, and then two attackmen stepped in as starters. It was really interesting to watch them develop. There's actually something similar to be said about Harvard's offense in the sense that Dewey Egan is the big physical dodger who's able to get his own looks while dodging from X. And then Lance Tillman is the quick, fast dodger who is also able to get his own looks while dodging from X and probably is a little bit of a better feeder. And the reason that's similar to Harvard is because Joey Graham took Austin Madronic's place as a starting attackman, and he is a big, strong, physical right-handed dodger who's very complementary to the, you know, small, quick left-handed dodger that we saw out of Sam King last year. So point being that you got two attack groups where, you know, there's two guys who, you know, can dodge and get their own shot and create offense, and then they're complemented by a third guy who's a little bit more of a shooter, McGovern, and Carolina's case, and Hayden Cheek in Harvard's case. So, you know, that's one element of the mystery. Carolina was going to need a little bit of answers at the faceoff X because they graduated Zach Tucci, who went on to play in PLL, and then an Under Armour All-American from a year ago ended up transferring to Penn State. So Andrew Tyer returns as their lone experienced faceoff guy, and then George Kalos, a freshman who was highly regarded coming out, did a nice job against a Harvard faceoff unit that graduated its number one in Stephen Cucurolo, but was in the low 60s in terms of faceoff win percentage and was running out a combination of Andrew DeGennaro and freshman Matthew Beccaro. DeGennaro was a scrapper similar to Cucurolo. Beccaro was able to win more clamps but was 2 days cleared from an injury, so still learning very much about how to play college lacrosse. And then at the defensive end for Carolina, they were without starters, Paul Barton, and then Matt Wright, who had been a long stick for most of his career, but it sounds like is going to make the move down low. So they're more confident and certainly more experienced at the rope unit, specifically the short stick D midfield, where Connor Maher and Alex Bresci both return, and they've got, you know, a trio of contributors behind them, led by Cooper Frankenheimer and freshman Leif Hagerup. So, Bresci referred to a trio of long stick middies who are in the mix to play. I didn't get who all of them are. I'm assuming that Rozelle is one, and I got the sense that Kai Prochazka was a second. Perhaps Evan Egan was the third, although I wasn't sure whether he was playing close or long stick middie. That was one of the effects of the jersey switch. And then pretty confident that Colin Krieg was the first half goalie. This was a really high-scoring contest. It was 19-18 at the end of regulation. Harvard won. I didn't get the sense that either goalie, and it was Christian Barnard for Harvard, played particularly well or particularly poorly. You know, it didn't seem like they were giving up goals that they shouldn't be giving up, but they certainly gave up a lot of goals. There were no official stats that were kept, so wasn't able to, you know whether they finished above or below 50%, for instance. But generally speaking, because of the absences, I don't feel like Carolina is I don't feel like they're any less mysterious than I would have felt or did feel last week. But at the same time, you know, I came away thinking these two teams are pretty similar, and certainly came away thinking that Carolina has the potential to be better than they were last year and a lot better than I expected them to be on the basis of my expectations, coming away from last season and heading into this fall.
That Under Armour All-American you're referring to, Chase Mullins, he's going to be, he's at State, the face-off specialist, so we'll get to see some eyes on him presumably next week if he's playing. You know, they have some scrimmages that they're going to be a part of. Real quick on Harvard, just give me your quick 30-second. You know, last year, I believe you called them the most mysterious team. There's not as much mystery now in terms of we saw them last year and we saw what they're capable of, and, you know, a lot of similar personnel returns for them. Can we expect what they built in 2022 to continue into 2023?
I think so. I think generally, just as an Ivy League-wide comment, we have to ratchet down how valuable fall is. I think this is true for Cornell and the other, you know, teams that we see this fall, because when we were seeing them last fall, there were so many unknowns. There was, you know, an entire class that was gone, two classes that had arrived, an entire roster of players who basically hadn't practiced for 2 years. How they looked was so important. That's not the case now, right? We have a group that, you know, six of the seven teams made the Ivy League or made the NCAA tournament, and they're all practicing this fall. So when I look at, you know, contrasting, it seems like, you know, there's essentially two groups, right? I think Cornell, Princeton, and Brown graduated a lot more, whereas Harvard, Yale, and Penn return much more similar and much more intact. I've already addressed two of the three spots that Harvard has to address. Well, actually, I addressed all four. So it was Joey Graham taking over for Austin Madronic, that duo taking over for Steven Cucurullo, and then it sounds like Christian Barnard is right now the leader in the clubhouse to be the starting goalie to take over for Kyle Mullen. So to me, their biggest issue is going to be how they manage the egos of having a lot of guys that should expect a lot more playing time because they got either a lot or a moderate amount of playing time last year as young guys and rightfully expect to get more because they all performed really well. And there probably just won't be enough minutes to go around. So they got to manage that.
One of the other real fun things we get to do in fall is go to a bunch of practices, you know, for our fall All Access series. I've been to a handful, Terry, you've been to a few. Kevin, you're right after we record this, you're going to get up the road on 95 to head up to Newark, Delaware. So we'll be looking forward to that. But, you know, with what we've seen so far, when you talk about story programs, we've talked about Cornell, we've talked about Maryland on this podcast so far, we've talked about North Carolina and Harvard. Johns Hopkins is as storied as it gets along there with Syracuse. And Terry, you've been to Homewood Field. I was there with you. I was taking photos. You were getting a more of an eye on the team. You know, Johns Hopkins, it's there's just not a team that has more discussion around the program than Johns Hopkins. You look at the message boards, you look at, the mainstream media attention that they get, the social media attention that they get. There's always a lot to be said about Johns Hopkins. So, you know, with your impressions of what you saw in practice, what was this practice about this year versus when you saw them, you know, a year ago around the same time when there was certainly a lot more questions heading into that fall?
Size and attention to detail. Last year, the big guys were the outliers. This year, the little guys were the outliers. And then the practice that I went to last year, Jameson Kester and John Grant Jr. were on the road recruiting, so Pete Milliman managed the entire thing more or less himself with his volunteer and in you know, contributing, right? Dan O'Nino handling one end of the field. And it felt like when practice was stopped and Pete addressed the whole group, it was to compel them to compete. This year, when practice was stopped and he addressed the whole group, it was about attention to detail. There were a couple of instances that I found particularly interesting. One, when the ball went out of bounds after a shot on extra man and the offense didn't chase the ball out of bounds, he said something to the effect of, if you guys thought it went off the defensive player, I understand. But it doesn't change the fact that you still need to get to the ball expediently so that you can pick it up and we can restart quickly. Not to mention the fact that you are putting it in the position, in the ref's hands to make a mistake. Don't let the ref be in a position where he could make a mistake. Get to the ball, because he might have thought it was a shot, not gone out off of a defensive player. And in that instance, the closest player to the ball gets the ball. Either way, it is our benefit to get there as quickly as possible. And it's not to say that the lesson was particularly, you know, groundbreaking, but it is to say that it's a level of attention to detail. Thinking about the way in which the third team on the field is going to react, they didn't have that luxury last year because he was still culturally trying to instill a we compete all the time at all costs, regardless of the circumstances. And it feels like, at least in his opinion, that standard has been met. And we can graduate or move on to the elements of the game that are a little bit more in the gray areas. You know, effort is black and white. Positioning yourself in order to get the be the beneficiary of a ref's decision, that is gray. You know, so he did something similar. They talked about how when you step on the field and are looking for a quick restart, don't immediately start running, because there are some officials who are going to say you got an advantage, they're going to bring you back, and then you blow the whistle. The way to get replay restarted as quickly as possible is step on the field, be 5 yards away from the sideline, hold your stick up and say, I'm ready, and then start running. And maybe you're going to get called back, but the likelihood is slimmer. And those were the elements of teaching that I felt like were a graduation from what I saw last year. So it is very hard, I think, to make the case on paper that the Blue Jays are going to be better than they were last year, because they don't have the talent of Joey Epstein or Connor DeSimone, it looks like, to rely on. But I think the combination of the fact that they were very clearly the 21st best team, they were 23rd in offensive efficiency, they were 21 in defensive efficiency, they were 21 in RPI, means that, like, when you're 21st, you might as well be 40th, right? In terms of the fact that the, you know, coaches and media polls are both top 20 and whatever else. You're not in the bubble conversation for getting in the NCAA tournament. But when you're 21st, you're only 5, 6, 7 spots away from being in legitimate NCAA tournament selection, at-large selection contention, which is a lot different from being 40th. So my point is that they weren't as bad as I think a lot of people conceived them to have been last year, meaning that the gap they have to close is a little bit smaller. And the ways in which they're going to improve are not through an increased aggregate in talent, but through the incremental improvement of the young guys that were on the roster that got playing time last year, as well as some guys who didn't play due to injury or you know, freshmen with a complete lack of experience. And then that type of learning how to play in the gray area and having an aggregate higher level of compete. And those are just things that aren't on paper. So do they happen? I don't know. I mean, practice is not a good it's not a good opportunity to evaluate it. If you get an opportunity to go to Homewood this weekend and check them out at the Headstrong event, you might come away with that impression of how much does their success in the gray area translate into success on the field.
When you talk about compete level, I'll talk about St. Joseph's, a team that I saw at practice a few weeks ago, and they were pretty into their practice schedule. And you know, I made the comment to you with your top 20 of like, you need to bump up St. Joe's a few spots. I think they're really good. I have a lot of, you know, maybe there's a little bit of recency bias in the fact that they were the second team I saw in fall ball. And, you know, I got eyes on them a lot last year. So familiarity sometimes breeds a little bit of favoritism in terms of, or just you get a little too high on a team because you know them so well. But I loved St. Joe's practice. I compared it to Yale practice from a few years ago. Actually, the fall before they won the national championship, I saw the Bulldogs. And, you know, I kind of walked away like, geez, like, Andy, what are you doing? Like, you're going to, like, someone's going to get hurt at your practice, like the way that you guys go at each other. And I thought the same thing at St. Joe's fall. You know, Levi Anderson and Levi Virch were just going at each other the whole practice. I don't know how Levi, like, has his arms still in his body the way that he was just soaking up checks. Taylor does not throw flags. He does not say, you know, that's a penalty, that's a penalty. Granted, that did hurt them in a key game last year against Drexel that they were so penalized. But I digress. The mentality of just compete and getting after it is just so far there. And it was up there among the most competitive and physical practices I've ever been to. That's saying a lot. And the thing that is interesting about that, you know, I remember periods of, you know, I want to say Kevin Warren's first year at Georgetown. I had a very similar, like, oh my gosh, he's running these guys so, you know, at each other. It's so physical. It's so competitive. I remember the early years of Sean Nadelin's tenure at Towson doing similar. Those were kind of like competition to create a culture that, you know, they've since sustained. The thing that makes this very interesting at St. Joe's is that this is a very senior and fifth year laden team. So this is just competition for their own sake, that this is just what they do at this point. You know, I didn't get the vibe that it was coaches hammering this into them. If anything, you know, I think the coaches were assessing, do we need to dial them back a little bit because they're going to kill each other out there? You know, so with a team that's this experienced and, you know, an entire starting attack unit that's back, they had Dwyer from Wagner, who kind of replaces the one hole that they had at midfield. They got one of the best faceoff specialists in the country. They had a goalie who came on last year and didn't start at the beginning of the year, but became their starting goalie. And they've kind of brought in, you know, reserves for him with the Gettysburg transfer, McMillan. So, like, you know, all the pieces are there. And through their 4 or 5 years of playing for St. Joe's, they've just built this competitive edge that I think was really impressive. I also saw Bellarmine a few weeks prior to that. It was very early in their scrimmage tenure. They were just playing a scrimmage versus each other, so it was quick. It was an hour in and out. And, you know, the thing that really stood out to me is the way that they get the ball up and out and off the field and make something happen in the middle of the field. Their long poles and their close defensemen are really aggressive. And, you know, Coach Whitley was talking after about, like, yeah, we've really put an emphasis on guys who get the ball up and out, because it's one thing to have an aggressive defense that causes turnovers, but if you cause a turnover and the other team just gets it back, you create a situation for the offense to do something. You know, the emphasis on them to get the ball and do something with it was very apparent, and that was very successful. They're a crafty team. They're a young team, not immature. I would say they were kind of in that immature range last year because they were too young. They're still young, but now they're to the point where they've grown a little bit. I think they're going to beat someone that they really, you know, maybe shouldn't beat on paper. But I also think that they have the risk of losing to someone that they shouldn't lose to. And then, Terry, we hit up.
I think you make a really good point and illustrate something that is also really important when it comes to the arc of a program underneath a particular coach. Taylor Ray has been the head coach at St. John's for like 12 years or so.
Terry, you're going to get the St. Joseph's fan base riled up again, like you did several times last year, and they're going to send you hate mail.
I'm very good at that. But
yeah, he's been there for a decade. He's either going into his 10th or 11th year.
Yeah. And then, you know, Pete Milliman is going into his third season, and Andy Whitley is going into his third season as well. So, you know, it's just a difference relative to how familiar the entire roster is with how you go about doing things. And to your point about they're going to kill each other, not at the behest of the coaches, but because it's just what they do. It's what they know. That is the reflection. And that is what is important. And, you know, fans can undersell it out of frustration because it's the only way to get it is time. And other coaches who think that their peers use it as an excuse can essentially think that they have the method to basically accelerate it, you know, and some of them are correct and some of them are not. You can talk about the value of it differently. That being said, just on the basis of like, would you rather have a longer tenure or not? It's really hard to make the argument that you'd rather be in your third year than in your 11th year in terms of your team's familiarity with your expectations for them.
Right. And to your point about, you know, the whole like these guys want to kill each other vibe, it goes the similar way with I remember, and I don't remember the context that this was in, but I remember John Tanowski saying, I don't want to make guys shoot all day. I want guys who just want to be out there shooting all day. And there's like that doesn't, you know, that happens in recruiting and you get guys who are like that, of course. But, you know, it doesn't sustain through just the individual. It sustains through the team as a whole. And Duke has built a culture where, you know, guys want to put in shooting work, not because Danowski's telling them to put in shooting work, but because that's the culture and that's what they value in that culture is doing that. And St. Joe's has done the same thing, you know, with the intensity that they bring to practice. Now, culture in your top 20, we're talking about Loyola and you had them ranked, I believe, number 19 in the rankings. This is kind of where we talked about the St. Joe's, you know, where does St. Joe's go? Where does Loyola go? We batted that back and forth a little bit. But one of the things that you said was, you know, you're kind of betting on the culture that's been at Loyola for them being included in the top 20. You went to their practice. I went there briefly with you. I didn't stay for the whole practice. They were a little light on numbers was kind of my first primary takeaway. But beyond that, what did you see from Loyola and what, you know, and what makes you feel that way culturally? Why is there a team that's relevant in the top 20, even when personnel wise, we might not think that they're there?
Yeah. So let me just tweak that a little bit. It's the term that I would use with respect to Loyola is infrastructure, not culture, because, mm-hmm. And the reason I feel that way is because I actually think that they suffered a little bit culturally last year by virtue of a lot of guys who didn't play with the level of urgency or fear that they needed to because of the experience that they had had the year before. And I think that the experience that they had had the year before, where their last five or six games were so magical, ended up being the catalyst for their decision to return, ultimately had a self-defeating effect. You know, it made the staff really reluctant to make changes because the prior year demonstrated that staying the course was beneficial. But on the other hand, you know, I think those players took for granted the prospect that their season wasn't over until it was over. And ultimately, you know, when the same game, Army in the Patriot League semifinals, is determined by one goal either direction, you know, we talked about the margins not being narrow enough or whatever in order to justify changing your jersey numbers in a scrimmage. But on the other hand, the margins can be so narrow that the difference between whether or not you beat Army by one goal in the Patriot League semifinals determines whether or not you are one goal away from the Final Four in overtime of the quarterfinals against Duke. Obviously their season ended against Army in 2022 and they won that game in 21 and had, you know, that pretty incredible next like 10-day stretch that ultimately ended with them being just a goal short after having led by three late in regulation. But even during 2021, Charlie Twomey talked about how culturally they weren't there. They weren't where they typically were because they couldn't spend any time in their locker room because of COVID protocols, because they weren't able to go on their fall retreat that they typically go on because of COVID protocols, because they weren't even on campus in the prior fall. So the point I was making about Loyola is about infrastructure. And the thing that affirmed that comment for me in terms of watching practice was they had 14 guys out due to injury, including a handful, injury and then also not being on campus this fall, which was the case for Peyton Rzonka, the short 60 midi, who has an invite to U.S. national team and is the only current, I believe, is Connor Schellenberger still involved? Peyton Rzonka is one of the few current college players
Hanley.
Still involved. Sam Hanley as well, in the tryout process. But ultimately, the infrastructure is that, like, you know, Loyola is kind of always on the borderline from a recruiting standpoint. And by that, what I mean is, you know, they're going to get a handful of four stars. They're going to get a five star once every 5 years, roughly. They're going to get a ton of three stars. You know, they're probably going to be ranked like the 12th class from a recruiting standpoint. And even though there were 14 guys out due to injury or other absences, I was still like, man, there's a lot of talent on this field. And the combination of talent and then the fact that Charlie Toomey, Matt Dwan, and Mark Van Arsdale are probably the oldest and most experienced staff in the entire sport, you know, which definitely has its, you know, benefits and detriments. But ultimately, I think shade's beneficial and potentially it doesn't even shade. It hedges substantially beneficial. It just yields the fact that they're always going to be competitive in the top of the Patriot League. And, you know, on a decade-long basis, they're going to be in the mix to make the Final Four three or four times. That's what the last 15 years have shown us. So, you know, it's not going to be their best team ever, and it's definitely going to be a team that's better at the end of the season than it is at the beginning of the season. But that's true for a lot of teams. And, you know, whether it's the freshmen, like, they really like the freshman group in total. And certainly, is it Matt Minicus? I get confused between
Brian
and, yeah. There are too many Minikai, particularly with three playing at three different institutions this spring. But thank you. I appreciate that laugh. Or the, you know, returning guys like Davis Lindsay, who popped at times last year, but ultimately didn't have the same level of consistency that you would have hoped. And then Evan James and Joey Kamish, who, you know, were similar and have popped a lot over the last 2 years, but have also struggled with injuries. You know, who it is going to be an open question with Kevin Lilly and Nate Nolstead. I'm sorry?
It is Matt Minnick. It's not Brian. Sorry.
Brian's at Georgetown.
Yeah, Brian's at Georgetown.
You know, there are still some questions, but, you know, a little bit fewer. And you know, probably the biggest is Bailey Savio was such an asset for them. And, you know, they didn't have a ton of depth at the faceoff X. Eric Pacheco wasn't at the practice that I was at because of class. You know, so I didn't come away with very much. Steve Vagnus, who's their volunteer, also wasn't there. So I didn't really come away with any additional answers as far as the faceoff is concerned. And, you know, based on the competition in High Point and Syracuse, I'm not sure that we're going to get a clear vision of that either from their fall scrimmage. But at each end of the field, they're going to be pretty talented. And, you know, we'll just see how much better they get over the course of the season.
Kevin, sorry, we've been having a little private conversation about our practices we've been to. you're going to some heavy hitters in the next, like, 7 days here. What's on your schedule?
Yeah, trying to catch up to you guys here with the upset of the tournament. Two teams I'm going to this week in Delaware right after this, and then Georgetown on Thursday. So that'll be really fun. And then try to parlay that into tomorrow next week.
So if you like this and want to come back next week, we'll be talking about the scrimmages upcoming and then at least Georgetown and Delaware on this podcast. This weekend's a really big scrimmage lineup. We've mentioned this Team USA event. You know, Maryland playing against the men's national team, also North Carolina women against the U.S. national team, and big weekend for Jenny Levy, who is going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And obviously she has her fingerprints in both of those, you know, the gold medal winning national team and the national championship North Carolina team. So kind of a celebration of her role in the sport this weekend. So that's going to be something fun to watch. As well as, you know, there's going to be a series of scrimmages involving Johns Hopkins. That's going to be at Homewood Field. So that's going to be something that I'm planning to go to. It's going to be Johns Hopkins and Fairfield as well. Sorry, excuse me here. Fairfield and UMBC are going to be there at Homewood. So I'll be checking that out. And Terry, the American Boy Fall Brawl is going to be another really high-profile event. It's at Centerville High School in Northern Virginia. Lehigh, Virginia, Penn State, Richmond, some really intriguing teams there. And obviously, Virginia, national championship contender, a team that's going to be in at least the top five, potentially even higher in every sort of preseason ranking that there is going to be this year. And then what I think on Friday night is going to be maybe the most revelatory scrimmage of the fall, Ohio State at Princeton. Princeton is, you know, a team that, Terry, you went into them when you're talking about some of the Ivy League teams. They're a national championship contender off the bat. Ohio State is a team that, you know, I think is properly rated in that between 10 and 15 range, but has potential to be one of those teams that we're looking midway of the season as a kind of a top five program in college across. And a lot of interesting developments there between NIL, their new stadium, and some of the guys that they're bringing in the transfer portal. So really looking eager to see that one. So, all right, guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.